made a pledge during our spring membership drive. Though we didn't quite reach the finish line, your love carried us far. Your pledges, your presence, your belief in WPFW. They remind us that this station is more than radio. It's a rhythm, a refuge, a revolution. We trust you'll keep walking with us, dancing with us, building with us. Because this community-powered radio station rises with you and only with you. Thank you for keeping the beat alive.
Peace, this is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
You know, nowadays, it seems like there's a lot of bad things going on, and I guess a lot of it, from the way I see it, seems to still stem from lack of feelings on our parts and how we relate or communicate with our fellow brothers and sisters. Hatred is a feeling, love is a feeling. Let's hate all that does not allow us to love. And we can do that just by getting to know each other and talking to the people. Who can you turn to tell your troubles? Tell them to. You can't go around wondering what it is you gotta do. You gotta be ready and willing, and willing to make a move. Nobody can push you if you don't wanna move. You suffer, cry, and hate, and live the American way. Fly the hateful skies of America. Fly the American way. Gotta talk to the people.
People, yeah, yeah. Yeah, gotta talk to the people. Good morning, good morning, good morning. This is Chip Jones today with WPFW's Community Watch and Comment Friday edition. A little change up today. Our normal captain, Ron Pinchback, is a little under the weather, so I'm going to be manning the show alone with a guest coming on a little bit later. Gay rights and AIDS activist, Robbie Davis. But let's start out with what's going on. This year marks the 55th anniversary of the Gay Pride celebration. This month's Gay Pride theme is about giving pride, highlighting the importance of giving back and celebrating with others and finding unity. For those of you who don't know, the initial Gay Pride celebration was focused on a single day. It was the last Sunday of June. It was done to commemorate June 28th's Stonewall Uprising in 1969. The Stonewall Inn was a Greenwich Village gay bar in New York City, which was owned and operated by the Genovese crime family, actually. During that time in New York, solicitation of same-sex relationships was illegal. The Genovese crime family, always taking an opportunity to make money wherever, opened a lot of gay bars in New York, which they would run quietly by bribing the New York police in order not to have any intrusion. On June 28th, the Stonewall Inn did not receive their usual warning of a police raid. And what happened is an armed group of police officers with a warrant entered the club and began roughing up patrons. And they found bootleg liquor. They arrested 13 people, including some employees, and people who at that time were violating the state's gender appropriate clothing statute. In New York, there was a law on the books that men had to dress as men and women had to dress as women. So the confrontation happened when the gay patrons decided not to just allow the police to bully them. And it turned into a brawl out on the streets. It overflowed the inn and went out into the streets of New York and lasted for 6 days, ending on July 2nd. That following year, June 28th, 1970, was the launch of the first Gay Pride Day. And since then, it's evolved to a month-long period of events and rallies in support of LGBTQ plus communities and their rights. So today we're going to spend a little time talking with Robbie Davis about the gay experience, gay rights, and AIDS activism. And then probably about at the halfway point of today's show, we will open up the phone lines for our traditional call-in and hear what people are thinking. So, Robbie, are you here with me?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
Well, thanks. Thanks for doing the show.
So, how are you feeling about Gay Pride this Gay Pride this year with everything that's going on with the White House? There seems to be an assault as there is with anything that is on the margins, any marginalized group by this administration to completely rewrite history, to push them to the side. How are you feeling about that?
Well, I mean, it's a big story because we had been in an era of kind of stasis in the United States. Globally, there's ongoing pride and gay rights issues and work done to help people feel safe in public and to change laws. And we've enjoyed since 1970 through a long and colorful history of oppression and struggle and community activism and community organizing and the AIDS crisis and response to AIDS and building community-based organizations and almost an alternative healthcare system, and then working within the system to change the way drugs were developed, and then taking all the knowledge of the response to AIDS and then taking that internationally. And that was really a lot of the leading work I was involved in, both in promoting AIDS awareness, health, and access to HIV drugs around the world, and particularly in Africa, and then in the realm of sport, the gay games developed in a parallel track to the course of the AIDS epidemic, founded in 1982, and the founder Tom Waddell died of AIDS after the second gay games, and that was a life force, positive through sport and culture, but primarily sport, pursuit of health and fitness. And that track was very important in the international development and international communications and organizing, because it was the largest sporting event, non-professional gathered multi-sport sporting event in the world, bigger than the Olympics in participation.
Wow, that's incredible. So let's wind back just a little bit before then. You yourself are gay, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and so how do you see the evolution of the, I guess, the society's change toward LGBTQ plus community? It seems like we have reached a certain point of openness. I wouldn't say it was perfect, but it seems like this administration is trying to push that back. And I was just wondering how you felt about, you know, how the progress had been going, and your recollections of how it used to be, and where it had come to.
Well, I mean, the reality is I came out in started to come out in 1979, and really more publicly when I was finishing university in 1982, and I rapidly became very politically involved. And the beginning of the explosion of the AIDS crisis was something that impacted me because I lived in New York City, and that was the largest impacted focal point in the United States. It was spreading most fast there. And we had, just because of population size, it was a higher percentage an issue. So it was an era that you didn't work on just gay rights. You worked on AIDS, you worked on taking care of friends. And a lot of that work was led by the lesbian community, taking care of the men in that community. And in many ways, it brought men and women together in a very great and collaborative, you know, community-based work. And that that work was then organized on a national level and taught. There were national organizations created here in Washington, D.C. to provide technical assistance to help other towns and communities prepare, prevent AIDS. And that, concurrent with that, was an explosion of gay pride parades and the emergence of something called InterPride, which is a kind of technical assistant advocate for helping communities produce pride parades, pride festivals, celebrate pride culture, and all the individual communities. So, you know, the reality is that we're everywhere, and we are the most diverse community, and from, you know, two-spirited indigenous folks to Black, brown, white, you know, red, yellow folks, and men, women, mothers, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, kids. So the diversity and all the issues and the is a very interconnected one. And so the when there's an attack now on that culture, and people try to treat and infuse fear into the community to try to repress it or oppress it, that it's a futile effort, but it's a kind of cultural violence that's being revisited. We're kind of taken back to 1975. And you know, when people were really afraid to come out, they wouldn't come out in the workplace. They weren't organizing in the workplace. They weren't educating in the workplace. A lot of the way the organizing happened in the workplace, again, was the response to AIDS, because people were having to make sure there was healthcare coverage and that folks with disabilities and HIV weren't discriminated against.
Right.
You know, there's a plethora of media out there, Philadelphia story, that kind of demonstrated how people in the workplace were discriminated against when they came out with AIDS in the workplace. Everybody was afraid. And so the emergence of community resource, employee resource groups was one of those things that brought that diversity of the community together. That's why it's very troubling that we have the DEI kind of attack that we have going on, because that's who we are. That's who America is. We are this mix of folks. There is no monolithic, you know,
us against them.
The war is created. The culture fraction is a bizarre power suppression that doesn't make any sense, and it's fueled by racism. It's fueled by misogyny, and we see it in the way immigrants are treated. We see it in women's rights being and healthcare being eroded, and governance and decision making over their own bodies. All of that is a war of creating otherness and creating an enemy, but we don't we aren't an enemy. We're family members.
Right. Exactly. One of the things that was amazing for me to come across basically this past week, the whole dynamic of creating an infrastructure and supporting AIDS treatment abroad, especially in Africa, how far-reaching that actually was, because once the AIDS epidemic started to become under control, the foundation that they created started to take care of other things, such as high blood pressure, such as diabetes, that whole structure that had been initially created to battle HIV and AIDS showed that it can be used to increase the healthiness of a country in many factors. And that's one of the things that's so devastating with the cuts that this administration has been doing overseas to organizations that in their mind were about, AIDS and Black people, is that it also took away health care for white people in South Africa that had diabetes, so.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's the multiplier effect of when you begin to address healthcare in places where there's less access. I mean, that happened first rurally here in the United States. It happened. Mm-hmm. And then there were the folks that set up, one man in particular, Buck Buckingham, who set up the Ryan White Act, left HHS, lent himself out to the State Department. And prior to George Bush's move, he was starting to do an assessment on the state of HIV and AIDS in Africa and had pretty much mapped out what the needs were. And then when George Bush dreamt up and made the political move to push for PEPFAR and keep getting it funded, that they were then able to implement that. Buck was a model in setting up the AIDS response in Kenya and then was providing technical support. And to this day, he has served in all kinds of international bodies and collaboratives. And part of that work was establishing health clinics, because you had to do follow-up, you had to do care. And then, so that built a structure, an alternative health system, or in some places, the first healthcare system that was contemporary or modernized, right, that did exactly what you said. It was delivering other good forms of disease management. And that's accompanied by all through this by organizations that funded the NGOs and, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Endowment, the Gates Foundation in massive quantities was addressing disease and epidemics and infectious disease. And that dovetailed really well with the work of PEPFAR. And the defunding of PEPFAR and USAID is possibly one of the cruelest and most
egregious,
imaginable, right. unimaginable acts, because it was with no warning. I mean, there was no way to replace that funding in such a short time frame, and it literally by just freezing it, and things started stopping. I mean, AIDS drugs were not made. I mean, people that were on treatment courses, those were taken away, and it's going to cause most likely millions of deaths in the continent of Africa. And but it's also come back here. I mean, this construct of the great big bill, or whatever you want to call it, contains so much material that it's going to erode. And it's in the myth of trying to cut budgets, which is minuscule and comparative to the overall budget, and why they're doing the tax cuts, it's not going to reduce deficits. It's just an act of insane cruelty to folks that are dependent on Medicaid expansion, dependent on the availability of therapies and follow-up and healthcare, and the ultimate you know, plot to try to undo Obamacare or the ACA. And the, this is a matter of life and death. It is. Right. It's going to cause devastation. It is causing devastation, just like it has with taking abortion away and access to mail order pills. I mean, all of that stuff is a war that's fueled by colossal hatred. And a lot of it is fueled by misogyny. A lot of it is fueled by racism and othering. And it's a created conflict. It's not, we evolved through a long civil rights history in this country across women, people of color, immigrant rights, LGBTQ plus community. And that the level of attack is unprecedented all at once. And they sometimes things are hidden, and there's sometimes it's used as a smokescreen because they're doing worse things elsewhere. So maybe the attack on immigrants claims the headlines, but then they're, you know, hiding stuff in the bill. Right. And the fact that we don't, you know, we did organizing in the March on Washington in 1987 because the 1987 march was first and foremost kind of a return to, it was the second gay march, and it was a return to picking the fight up because everybody had been distracted by responding to AIDS. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really have HIV and AIDS on the agenda. And the AIDS activists, as we were launching ACT UP, started organizing weekly and having phone calls. And we had a concurrent set of organizing meetings during the March on Washington in 1987 that planned the following year, a week-long set of protests that culminated in a very dramatic piece at the FDA. And that was an unprecedented group of men, women, gays, lesbians, people of color, indigenous people that were planning that. And it was everybody had a place at the table. And there was a documentary group called Testing the Limits that was in the throes of documenting ACT UP and began documenting this kind of organizing and the stories of the reality of the impact of AIDS and how the community was self-defending because the government wasn't responding. And that that piece was phenomenally empowering. And we've learned from that, but we didn't keep it to ourselves. You know, it ultimately was taught to other communities. It was taught to other countries. We started ACT UP and we did safer sex prevention in Brazil and Ireland and France. And the UK was a partner in so many things that we did. And then they taught the rest of the world, and that, you know, then the Dutch took a leading hand in bringing and in supporting access to healthcare and HIV drugs in South Africa. I was actually a massage therapist. My rowing took me to Amsterdam. I was a massage therapist, and Donna Shalala, the Health and Human Services Secretary, booked a session with me. She was at a meeting at the Hilton in Amsterdam with the health ministers of the world. And I was kind of surprised that, you know, she was there. And I don't do this. I don't violate the sanctity and the quietness of a bodywork session. Mm-hmm. But I called the top an AIDS activist in New York State, and who was monitoring drug development and access to drugs and working with the AIDS Institute in New York State. And I said, what's the number one global issue right now? And he said, access, compassionate use and access to AIDS drugs for Africa. And, you know, we pay tens of thousands of dollars for HIV drugs. I have been HIV positive for nearly 40 years. And my weekly medical costs, or my yearly medical costs just for pharmaceuticals pushes $60,000 a year. Mm. Well, that's completely unattainable for an African. And so that was the issue at the time. That was in the 90s, late 90s. But And so I apologized at the end of the session. I said, but as an HIV positive man and as an AIDS activist and as someone who's worked for healthcare access, we need you to advocate in the Clinton administration to take a position on making the AIDS drugs available and generics available at an affordable price for the Africans so they can have access to healthcare, because the epidemic was heavily centered in the African continent, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. And the Gates Foundation was even then soon starting to do things, but I mean, they're even though it's been billions of dollars over the years, it dwarfs what PEPFAR was doing.
Right.
And so she said, that's exactly what we're talking about here. I'm not upset that you've brought it up, and we are taking a very strong position on it. So it was even in the Clinton administration, you know, she had been dean of the public health school before that, and she was very versed, and she served the entire Clinton administration as HHS. She was an expert in running HHS comparatively to today. It's like night and day. I mean, they're completely they're blowing up healthcare in America. They're blowing up research. They're blowing up. I mean, it's violent. It's not a matter of, oh, well, we just won't fund this next year. You stop research, you destroy all the samples, all the lab work going on, all the genetic research going on. You interrupt that and you take it back by years. It's people don't realize the scale and scope of what goes on. The NIH is losing scientists. It's losing, I mean, people can't just stay frozen. They're committed their lives to advancing science, and they're gonna find funding. They're gonna go to another country. They're gonna do something to keep making an impact. And so it's not just, oh, well, we'll take away access to, you know, having diversity in the workplace or, you know, talking about it at colleges and impacting free speech. It's the fact that they're undoing basic protections. I mean, it's insanity that there's a war on vaccines. We just came through a global pandemic. And in lightning speed, because of genetic research, because of the Genome Project, they were able, and because of the newest techniques, they were able to develop vaccines and test them fast and build the models and, you know, all at the genetic level and implement it and then to know that it was safe. And then they did the trials in short order. They proved it, and then they implemented it, and they got it out globally. This would have been hundreds of millions of people dying of COVID if that hadn't happened. And the work of the NIAID and those organizations was beyond heroic. And they had learned in the action of AIDS. They had learned by working with the LGBT community in partnership to do things in a faster track, to make the FDA efficient and more in communication with the NIH. All of that is undone now by a madman, really, who doesn't trust vaccines for with no scientific knowledge and bad information and never has data to back up anything he claims, and he's making policy.
Right.
And
okay, I'm gonna do this. We're a few minutes away from the half hour, and I'm going to tell people to go to the phones at 202-588-0893 after the break, and we'll start taking phone calls. But what I want to get from you, we've gone through the history, your personal history, and your institutional history of what's gone on. In this month of Gay Pride, what gives you hope? What gives you optimism? I guess the bright side of the Pride Month that you are holding.
Well, actually, so Pride Month here is a month long thing, but Pride is a year long thing all over the world. Pride is not just celebrated in June. Right. So we mark the anniversary of the 69 uprising, and June in general is the highest density of events in the United States. And Washington, because it has World Pride this month. World Pride happens every. I don't know what the schedule of World Pride is, but once it's selected and they implement it, it's every few years and in a different country. And they have they really invite the world to that country. It has a huge economic impact on whatever the country is. Probably the original projections for Washington, D.C. is it would have an $80 million, $100 million plus economic impact for D.C. It's mm-hmm. now being boycotted. It's now being, right. You know, the Kennedy Center events were blown up.
Right.
The chorus is still went and then found venues and churches and the Library of Congress to perform.
A lot of the world doesn't want to travel here. They're afraid.
No, I'm a swimmer, and we had the international swimming competitions. IGLA is the International Gay and Lesbian Aquatics. It's been around since 1983 or four, after the gay games, and to promote aquatics. We are an international body of tens of thousands of swimmers and divers and synchronized swimmers and water polo players. And we have an annual competition every 4 years. It's inside the confines of the gay games. It's the largest sporting event at the Gay Games. We have sometimes 1,700 aquatics athletes. That's the size of the Winter Olympics. And there's people from 68 countries that come to those competitions. So that was held here this week. And I got to see my friends, and that was that's a huge celebration and life-affirming activity. People swim until they're 90 years old. And competitively and in U.S. swimming, and that we had world records broken this week in the new aquatic center in Fairfax. I'm sorry, in Alexandria, and at least three world records were broken, and in master swimming, and so the entire span, it kind of kicked off with events, and then it went into D.C. Black Pride over Memorial Weekend, which is an annual event. And now it's another week-long series of performances and celebrations. There's a rally on the mall. There's another march on Sunday, this Sunday. And those are not about, often the news covers them in very little tiny sound bites and pieces. And you see people in, you know, leather or extreme wear on a float, and people in drag queens. Instead of celebrating the empowerment of drag queens who led the fight in 1969, it's seen as, you know, this crazy otherness. And mm-hmm. that what's important about a pride parade is that you see gay firemen, you see gay policemen, you see gay service members, you see, every division of the armed forces and out marching in there. The reason why they're in waves and affinity groups is to show the diversity, to celebrate right. the diversity, to show kids and young people that, you know, there's a place for you in the world. There's role models, there's heroes, there's that's really the celebration of pride right. and the statement. And, you know, it's claiming your place and right.
they're your
also
neighbors,
opening
they're
the way, right. And it's opening the way for people to say, to have the courage to come out and to not be afraid.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you so much. We're at the halfway point and we're going to break away for a minute, but I really want to thank Robbie Davis for talking to us. I don't know if you're going to stay with us. That's up to you, but sure. I really appreciate you coming in and helping me flesh this out, you know? So, I hope that I will be get a chance to get down to the mall sometime this weekend.
The rally will be, and the speakers will be a brilliant display of who LGBTQ plus people are. And it's going to be very international. It's not just a regular DC pride.
Thank you. All right. Let's go away for a break for a moment. And when we come back, the phones will be open,
202-588-0893. Hi, I'm Robin Holden.
Hi, I'm Miyuki Williams.
WPFW and Parks and People invite you to the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, from 12 noon until 8 p.m. at Malcolm X Park.
It's a family-friendly celebration of culture, community, and resistance during the week of Juneteenth and the summer solstice.
Experience the power of WPFW's on-air voices brought to life with featured speakers Anthony Browder and Reverend Lennox Yearwood.
Live performances by Saiz Kamaluddin, Kabah, and Proverbs, plus DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog, keeping the vibe alive.
Connect in the community led by Milani Douglas. Explore art curated by Adrian Ferguson and enjoy intergenerational fun with activities for elders and children alike.
That's Sunday, June 22nd at Malcolm X Meridian Hill Park from noon until 8 p.m. Registration at eventbrite.com.
It's a jazz and justice festival, the WPFW way.
WPFW.
Building a better world.
One broadcast at a time.
And we're back. This is Community Watch and Comment, Friday edition. I'm Chip Jones, your host. Our number again is 202-588-0893. And I want to thank Robbie Davis again for joining us. Robbie, are you still here with us?
Yes, of course.
Okay, great. Yeah, so phones are open. I'm looking to see. I don't think we have any callers as yet. But, yeah, so it is amazing, I think, to me that this administration is getting away with such havoc that there haven't been as many people pushing back. I do think we have one caller on the line, so let's go ahead and go to the caller. Hello, caller, are you there?
Hello, Chip. This is Rick calling you from Germany, brother.
Hey, Rick.
Is your guest still online?
Yes, he's still with us.
What?
Hello.
Tell him to say his name again.
It's Robbie Davis.
Robbie Davis. Brother Davis, I would like to disagree with you about the testing of the COVID vaccine and the 100% assurance that it was safe. But I would also like to acknowledge your humanity as a human being and someone worthy of respect. I am not a gay man, but I had to come to some assessment of where I stood on the gay lifestyle, the gay choice, or the gay humanity at 12 years of age. By the time I was 16, I was firm and resolute that gay people were just as deserving of respect there in America as I was as a Black American. But I have a question for you. Do you believe that Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan has made some small peace with the gay community and directed his nation to follow suit?
I'm not currently familiar with his positions or statements. I'm not aware of a current conflict. I haven't seen really great coverage on him lately. So I've also been in a bit of a media blackout the last couple of weeks because I was on retreat. I'm assaulted by what's coming out of the White House and the administration, but I am, because that just gets exploited in the media. I haven't heard a lot of diverse voices.
How do you feel about it, Rick? Do you think that Farrakhan has come to some sort of agreement with gay and lesbian style?
I think in his speeches the last 15 years, he has attempted to make some peace. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that will last after his passing. I think the man in the White House is doing his best to appeal not only to the racist, but the Christian fundamentalists. And mm-hmm. he is much worse then I think the Nation of Islam and I'm running out of words here. I think the man in the White House has more power than Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, and I think if he pushes an anti-gay, anti-transgender agenda, then people in the streets will follow that and act accordingly in bias.
Right.
I'm done, fellas.
Thanks, Ray.
I think the important thing is that America gets confused by Nation of Islam is only one sector of Islam, and the global Muslims have also vary, just like the Catholic Church varies all over the world. The Muslim political positions and rights are different. Some Muslim cultures are more open with women's rights, and women aren't as oppressed or suppressed. Some countries, they're severely suppressed, and that often accompanies having no LGBTQ rights. And so and that gets confused with what the Nation of Islam is in the United States and what Muslim Americans are, which are a larger population, right? In a larger population sector. And there's many different ways that the Muslim religion is followed in America. So you can't just hold out one person as the voice for everybody, just like you can't hold out one rabbi as the voice for everybody.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing is that there is so much, in the quote unquote manuals, which, are the books or the Bibles of each religion, there is so much diversity in them, and there are people who seem to adhere to certain parts and not others, who focus on, fundamental Christians seem to focus on gay and lesbians as the, God's, well, it says in the Bible, but, in the Bible it also says, not to wear clothes of different types of different types of threading. I mean, there's so many things that they don't follow anymore. Don't touch the hide of a pig, yet they're all football fanatics. So it's amazing. I think the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, has maybe five passages about, one could say were about anti-gay or lesbian, but it has like 550 passages about inequity between the poor and the wealthy. And why do we focus on something that's only mentioned five times and not something that's mentioned 500 times?
And I think it's important to, remember the film. I think it's The Bible Says It So. The film that Archbishop Jim Robinson, the first Anglican gay bishop, was eloquently interviewed and set inside and really revealed a deeper understanding of a lot of the traditional New Testament and scripture writings on what they saw as same-sex love or same-sex relations. Right. And that's a whole important component to revisit and to understand. It's a film that's not appreciated enough. And it was set in multi-religion context as well. So that's a critical piece, but the Catholic Church has made huge advances in the way it approaches homosexuality and not shaming people about their bodies, which is where a lot of the fear of sexuality is rooted. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, so we've got another caller. Let's go over with another caller. We want to get in on the conversation. Hello, caller, you there?
Yes, I am. Is it me is what I'm wondering right now.
It's you. It's you.
Excellent. I have heard your guest say that we had a vaccine idiot or something of that nature in power. But I have read the book The Real Dr. Fauci by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I can't help but notice that he put stats in his book talking about the not only AIDS but the vaccine effectiveness
right.
AZT right. for or the ineffectiveness of AZT and how it seems like the gay community was fighting for a very deadly drug and calling for it to be spread in Africa despite charts that showed it had a toxicity that was off the charts. And the same thing, he also has stats in his book showing a negative correlation between deaths and the vaccines that they have come up with. I'd like to hear things based on facts and stats, not on calling people names. There's nothing crazy about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and anybody who uses stats to put forth a point of view of something that he's had years of experience with being director of the Children's Health Fund, he's not a crazy person, and I don't think that you're taking the effect that the drug companies make a lot of money on not testing other effective treatments and calling for certain things that only seem to make the drug company money. I want to hear his response to that.
Well, the one thing I want to say is when you say you got stats from him, now the report they just put out, the MHAA had 7 reports in it that didn't even exist. They were figments of imagination. So just because somebody can put something out in a book statistically doesn't mean that it's true.
Oh, you're saying that it's a book of lies and that somehow all these experts that he's quoting in this book are going along with lies?
It may be.
I don't buy that. I do not buy that he's crazy. And I do, but if something like that has occurred, I'm not sure why it's not headlined in every paper that there is, because I haven't seen the stats that you're saying.
Well, what I have seen in magazines and papers is that this idea that AZT is such a dangerous drug and that it's killed, you know, hundreds of thousands of people is not true. I mean, in fact, there was an article 2 years ago, I think, on USA Today that was going back through the history of this, that this has been an ongoing lie about AZT. That it has not killed hundreds of thousands of people.
It was a toxic drug.
I don't know. Excuse me.
Okay, I'll speak from... Hold on.
Go ahead.
I'll speak from experience, okay? Direct experience.
Let me answer what was just said. The drug companies are very, very effective at advertising. And with Fauci, according to his book, what they failed to do is come up with other drugs that competed and compare with comparative studies. And the studies that he put forth in his book, which have not been, his book has been out for a while and it has not been recited. In fact, he has experts, PhDs, and some of these are prize-winning experts.
Okay, I want to back up a second, okay? Because if that were true, if all of any, hang on a second, sir. If any of that were true, he would have delivered the statistical information when he was brought before the Senate Oversight Committee and the Health and Human Services Oversight Committee in the current Congress. I don't know that they held very in-depth coverage. The Senate was more rigorous with that. People like Patty Murray, who's my senator, was extremely rigorous with that. He did not deliver it with facts and figures when he was under oath. So that's important. I can't speak to the publications because I wasn't the editor. I don't know what their legal review was. I don't know if those studies were studies or reviews of 8 rare people or if they were hundreds of thousands of phase 3 clinical trials. I will speak from experience with AZT. In 1987 and 1988, when AZT began its clinical trial application and went into use. I was in those clinical trials. I took single dose therapy of AZT, single monotherapy. That was the only thing that they had any hope at that point because it was the most advanced in scientific research. So that was the first drug out of the gate. It was highly toxic, and they randomly tried several different doses. And the first dose that they tried was extraordinarily difficult to tolerate, and it was very toxic. It did not kill people. AIDS killed people.
Right.
So but that was the first thing, and they tried. And we in ACT UP and other activists, and Dr. Fauci and his rigorous work, was leading the fight to do multiple things. As soon as AZT was out in clinical practice, they were doing research on other analogs of it. Those first few analogs were toxic, and they were not very effective, but they kept trying.
Right.
And the research went on, and we had massive meetings. There was a meeting in June of 1982, I believe it was, maybe 87. It was 1987 here in Washington, D.C. at the Hilton. And the room was 4,000 scientists and 3,000 members of the global media. And finally, things were really getting attention, and multitudes of drugs were going into development and were, you know, all along the way, there's been science. And from the earliest stages, there was an organization, an international cooperative of vaccine developers, the man that helped organize a lot of AIDS in the workplace education named BJ Stiles was leading the fight in international vaccine development. There were two tracks of vaccine development starting in the early 90s for treatment and inoculation and suppression of the virus, and there was research for vaccines for prevention.
Right.
That it's a squirrely, gnarly, difficult virus. It mutates fast, and the nature of a retrovirus is that it hijacks the immune system and uses the immune cells to replicate. So it's extraordinarily difficult to buffer and raise the immune system and then be able to control the virus. And so that makes the vaccine development very difficult. So that's why to this day we don't have an HIV vaccine. But
we don't have a vaccine for cancer, and you can't name a single cancer drug that isn't toxic. I mean, my sister was on chemotherapy for almost 5 years. Every single drug that they used was toxic. It extended her life by 5 years. But, you know, this idea that there's going to be a silver bullet for every disease that's going to be, you know, as pure as water, I think it's not the reality of life.
But what is the reality is the fact that the Genome Project was completed by the NIH and the scientists there, and they have led the way up until this point with funding to do massive genetic research, most recently moving to a model of zebrafish, which condenses the time of animal clinical trials and testing in the first in living entities. It's called in vivo versus in vitro, which is in the test tube.
Right.
And that's a great human model. And so they're able to do unbelievably rapid research on everything from limb regeneration and stem cell work, not from abortion fetuses, but from genetic matter and stem cells in zebrafish. And that is an area that is going to ultimately enable the tailoring of medicines to be less toxic, to be more manageable, to be set in like numbers of people, and maybe even down to person, to be able to tailor a therapy directly to make it as efficient and as directly focused on that kind of cell growth or that tumor or that different cancer or the way that cancer is metabolized in that body that has other issues going on in it. That's the future of medicine. That's the future of genetic research. And that is all what is being literally blown up like a nuclear bomb has been dropped on the NIH. It's unfathomable.
Okay. I think that we are almost out of time. I want to thank Robbie Davis for sitting in with me today. And I'm hoping I get to hang out with you personally while you're here. So
that's guaranteed. I very much appreciate being invited in, and I'm happy that you had callers that had deep questions.
Yeah, we have a great audience. You know, even the people that I don't agree with, they are smart. They read, and it's always good to have a conversation with them. So it's we have a plethora of well-reasoned, well-studied, and articulate guests. And I think that pretty much takes us up to time. I think my engineer will let me know if I'm correct.
You didn't play any music.
You know, nowadays, it seems like there's a lot of bad things going on, and I guess a lot of it, from the way I see it, seems to still stem from lack of feelings on our parts is how we relate or communicate with our fellow brothers and sisters. Hatred is a feeling, love is a feeling. Let's hate all that does not allow us to love. And we can do that just by getting to know each other and talking to the people. Who can you turn to tell your troubles? Tell them to. You can't go around wondering what it is you gotta do. You gotta be ready and willing to make a move.
Hi, I'm Robin Holden.
Hi, I'm Miyuki Williams.
WPFW and Parks and People invite you to the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, from 12 noon until 8 p.m. at Malcolm X Park.
It's a family-friendly celebration of culture, community, and resistance during the week of Juneteenth and the summer solstice.
Experience the power of WPFW's on-air voices brought to life with featured speakers Anthony Browder and Reverend Lennox Yearwood.
Live performances by Saiz Kamaluddin, Kaba, and Proverbs, plus DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog, keeping the vibe alive.
Connect in the community led by Milani Douglas. Explore art curated by Adrian Ferguson and enjoy intergenerational fun with activities for elders and children alike.
That's Sunday, June 22nd at Malcolm X Meridian Hill Park from noon until 8 p.m. Registration at eventbrite.com.
It's a Jazz and Justice Festival, the WPFW way.
WPFW.
Building a better world.
One broadcast at a time.
WPFW, in collaboration with the Josephine Butler Center, present the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. An activation of music, poetry, social justice teach-ins, visual art, wellness, children's activities, and more in Malcolm X Park. WPFW personalities Saiz Kamaluddin, Kaba Soul Singer, and Proverbs Reggae Band will be among the performers, with sets by DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog. Also featured will be an art show curated by Adrian Ferguson of The Art of Noise and a community curated by Milani Douglas. Stay tuned to WPFW for updates and details.
Everybody say bless, say bless, say bless.
Yeah! Bless.
Thank you, family. We're so grateful for each and every one of you who made a pledge during our spring membership drive. Though we didn't quite reach the finish line, your love carried us far. Your pledges, your presence, your belief in WPFW. They remind us that this station is more than radio. It's a rhythm, a refuge, a revolution. We trust you'll keep walking with us, dancing with us, building with us, because this community-powered radio station rises with you and only with you. Thank you for keeping the beat alive.